Ladies and gentlemen, we want to get our program underway, and we encourage you to continue with your dessert and coffee. I'm Jonathan Fanton, president of the MacArthur Foundation, and I'm delighted to be here, and I want to begin by thanking Bill Perry and Gloria Duffy and their colleagues for bringing us all together to talk about the implications of the proposed U.S. deployment of a national missile defense system. Bill and Gloria, you've assembled really a terrific group, and our two foundations are pleased and proud to be supporting this conference. And while this is a group of diverse views, so we are not all of a single mind on all aspects of the complicated set of issues we're about to talk about, I do expect and I certainly hope that we're united in the view that the issues are sufficiently important as to merit deeper discussion among experts and with the general public. Last May, some of us gathered at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington to consider the wisdom of deploying the National Missile Defense System at a time when the decision seemed imminent. Those present at that bipartisan gathering decided to send a letter to President Clinton urging delay so there could be fuller discussion of the profound diplomatic consequences of deployment and an exploration of alternatives that would not violate international treaties. Now, we all know the failure of the July test did more than the letter that came from that earlier conference, although it certainly confirmed doubts that were widely discussed by us in May, and the president deferred the decision. So there now is the time that we had asked for the fuller and more public discussion. And yet both presidential candidates have put themselves on record favoring a missile defense system of some form. And there exists, I fear, a general assumption within the public at large that some sort of system will be deployed as soon as it can be shown to work. And yet there's still been little public discussion of the likely diplomatic consequences or of possible alternative system designs such as the boost phase intercept. And we hope the conversation that we're going to have over the next 2 days will consider how to broaden out, deepen this discussion of national missile defense. Tonight, Bill Perry is going to frame the issues for us. And tomorrow, we'll explore the status of the proposed MD system and its various alternatives, as well as the geopolitical and commercial implications of deployment. And it's now my pleasure to turn the microphone over to our co-host, Gloria Duffy, who is the CEO of the Commonwealth Club, and I'm sure known to virtually everyone here, especially for her good work as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, a role in which she was deeply involved, really playing a key role in the Cooperative Threat Reduction Program, which had such a good outcome. Gloria?
Thank you very much, Jonathan. And hello, friends. I'm very pleased to join Stanford and our foundation colleagues in welcoming you this evening. We have a much broader collaboration going here with this conference tomorrow than is typical. Two foundations, a university, and a public forum, the Commonwealth Club. And this indicates the importance we ascribe to the issue of missile defense. We're not only having the dinner this evening, we're having the conference tomorrow. We're going to have a public program tomorrow evening, a panel discussion here in Palo Alto, trying to engage the public and broaden the discussion even a little more on the missile defense issue. And, of course, you're all invited to that. It will be following the conference tomorrow here in Palo Alto. A decision on whether to proceed with deployment of a space-based or other missile defense system is one of the first major defense policy issues a new president will face. Both candidates took positions, as you know, during the campaign. Hopefully that was the campaign, and there's probably some room for some new thinking in the transition period and after the inauguration of whomever we might have for president. One of the most useful roles a group like that, which we'll meet tomorrow, can play is to indicate what the criteria should be for a decision on missile defense, on what basis the decision should be made. Even before we meet, it's clear that consideration should include more than just the question of whether the system will work or not. What are the alternatives to the system for dealing with ballistic missile threats? What are the geopolitical and security consequences of going ahead with a missile defense system? What about the economic costs, as well as the technical capabilities of the system? So these will be the themes of our meeting tomorrow, which will hopefully result in some recommendations or conclusions that will be provided to the new president's transition team and to the new administration, whoever that might be. But we're also, as I indicated with the mentioning the public meeting tomorrow evening, we're going a step further to stimulate public debate, of which there has been very little on missile defense. Not only will we have the public discussion tomorrow evening, but the four partners are also going to be putting up a web portal. For those of you who don't speak Silicon Valley, that's a place online where people can go to find information about missile defense and to discuss it online with other people who are interested. And that will actually be up and running as of Friday, and it will be a way to continue the discussion that will start at the conference. And that will be at www.commonwealthclub.org/missile defense. It will post documents from the conference, links to other sites where there's information on missile defense, and also there will be threaded discussions where people can come and discuss the issue in an ongoing way. So that said, I would now like to turn to my conference co-chair, former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry, who certainly needs no introduction in this group, who is going to frame the issue of national missile defense. Dr. Perry.
Thank you very much, Gloria. Thank you, Jonathan. I can't tell you how delighted I am to see so many friends and colleagues in this room tonight. Most of you see me primarily at conferences or on airplanes. And so you may be surprised to learn that I have a day job, which is teaching at Stanford. In fact, each year I teach a class that I call The Role of Technology in National Security. And this quarter, I have in that class 140 students. Half of them are graduate students in engineering, and the other half are political science majors. I teach this class by case study, covering four cases in each quarter. The second case treated this quarter was the upcoming decision on deploying a national missile defense system, which I will probably call NMD in this talk tonight. So when I say NMD, I mean National Missile Defense. In this case, as in the others I treat in the course, I see my role as one of framing the issue for the students. I lay out the facts, I invite experts on the subject to speak to them, and have them read papers by advocates of different positions. Now, in the case of NMD, most of the papers that I used in my course were written by people who will be speaking at the conference tomorrow. Then, when that is done, I ask each of the students to imagine that they are on the new administration's foreign policy transition team. And as such, they have been asked to prepare a white paper advising the new president-elect what actions he should take on the National Missile Defense Program after he takes office. Now, I'm confident that the new president will be thrilled when he learns that papers from 140 Stanford students are available to guide him on his upcoming decision. Tomorrow, we will have a working conference on national missile defense, where the participants will not be graduate students, but some of the best informed, the most thoughtful scholars and practitioners in this field. Following the conference co-chairs, Dr. Duffy and myself, will draft a letter to the president-elect, if only we can discover his name. It's difficult to know how to address it at this time. We'll be offering him our best advice on what actions he should take on national missile defense. Now, this letter will not be a consensus of the views of the conference participated. It is really not feasible to reach a consensus given the diversity of views which we have deliberately represented at this conference. But our advice to the president-elect will be informed by the wisdom, by the facts, and the logic arising from the conference. Now, my task tonight is not to tell you what I think the president-elect should do. It is not to argue for or against any of the diverse positions on this complex topic. My task tonight is to frame the issue, just as I tried to do with my class. And I hope that this framing will be a guide for the discussion tomorrow, so that this conference, unlike many others on this subject, will generate less heat and more light. So what are the issues, and how should we be addressing them? First, is there or will there be a threat? Because our conference is an academic meeting, we will not have access to classified information, so this is not the forum to critically examine the intelligence on the threat. We start out then with a limitation, which I want to frankly acknowledge. But detailed threat estimates have been published by qualified authors who do have appropriate access to the intelligence data. And moreover, there is a reasonable convergence in their estimates. They lead to the judgment that several third world nations hostile to the United States may succeed this decade in deploying missiles that could threaten the United States. Divergence in the national debate, then, is less over the threat than the significance of the threat and what to do about it. Which takes us to the next issue. Do these missiles, if deployed, significantly increase the danger to our national security? Well, if the missiles have nuclear warheads, the answer to that question is certainly yes. But the answer is not so clear if they do not. So we will discuss tomorrow what our relative concern ought to be for high explosive warheads, chemical warheads, or biological warheads. Such warheads are far easier for the presumed threat nations to acquire, but they pose a very different threat than nuclear warheads. So it is important in our discussion to discriminate among the specific threats we are considering. Well, given that we are concerned about the missile threat, we must also examine other ways of dealing with it. Throughout the Cold War, we faced a much greater nuclear missile threat without a national missile defense. During that period, our national security depended on the effectiveness of our deterrence forces, which are still overwhelmingly powerful. So we need tomorrow to examine the extent to which we are willing to continue to make our national security dependent on deterrence. Is deterrence somehow ineffective against the third world nations looming as future threats? If so, why? And what can be done to make it more effective? We must also look at the issue of other threats. If we defeat the ICBM threat, do we make our nation secure from the danger posed by the proliferation in the third world nations? Here the answer is clearly not. Those nations would still have the possibility of delivering their weapons of mass destruction with airplanes, cruise missiles, merchant ships, and delivery vans, none of which would be affected by a national missile defense system. So we should discuss the relative importance of ICBMs as a delivery means and the relative priority our nation should give to defending against that particular delivery vehicle. And we must look quite squarely at the issue of the probable effectiveness of national missile defense. That is, what level of security we can hope to get with it. There is considerable controversy about the effectiveness of the national missile defense system now being developed. Much of this controversy revolves around the countermeasures that could be used against it and the likely success of the countermeasures designed into the system. This issue, like the threat issue, cannot be fully discussed at an unclassified conference, and so our answers here cannot be conclusive. However, we can get a look at the long history of air defense systems to get some feel for the range of uncertainty. I start off by observing that there never has been a perfect air defense system. Typically, defensive systems are measured by the rate of attrition that they exact from an attacking force. And of course, from the defensive system point of view, the higher the attrition, the better. Now, going back a little bit in history, prior to World War II, it was thought that bombers would have an enormous advantage over any defensive system. But with the development of radar just before the Second World War, the relative advantage swung back to the defense. Indeed, early in the war, the combination of British Spitfires and ground radar inflicted such high attrition rates on the Germans that they were forced to abandon their relatively precise daytime bombing of England. And with that decision, the Germans also had to abandon their hopes of winning the Battle of Britain, with all that that portended for future history. All during World War II, the advantage shifted dynamically from offense to defense and then back again as new measures and new countermeasures were introduced. During this period, the effectiveness of air defense system varied from attrition rates as low as a few percent to as high as 20 or 30%, with the higher rates making it impractical for the other side to sustain a bombing offensive. All during the Vietnam War, the United States conducted a sustained bombing campaign against a moderately capable Vietnamese ground air defense system that exacted attrition rates of a few percent on our bombers. By the time of Desert Storm, the United States had introduced stealth aircraft, which decisively shifted the advantage to the offense so that Iraqi air defenses had remarkably low attrition rates, less than 0.1%. Now, I go over this history not because I believe that air defense is the same as missile defense, but to make two general points about defensive systems. The history of attrition rates that defensive systems have been able to achieve had varied dramatically from a tenth of a percent, as low as a tenth of a percent, up to as high as 30%. So it is reasonable to expect a significant range of variation in the attrition that a missile defense system can affect as measures and countermeasures range in a dynamic fashion. Of course, in a missile attack, the dynamics will occur before the attack, and our missile defense planners will generally not know what progress the future attacker has made in countermeasures. But I will also remind you that we have never fielded a perfect defensive system, nor have we even come close to achieving 90% attrition rates. So we should not expect a national missile defense system of any design to eliminate the missile threat. The best we can hope is that it will reduce the level of damage that could be caused by the missiles. If our national missile defense system could achieve a truly impressive attrition rate of, say, 70% against an attacking force of, say, 10 missiles, we would be thankful that those 7 missiles did not strike our cities. But we would also suffer serious damage from the 3 that did. So the value of a missile defense system should be measured in terms of the level of damage reduction we can expect from it against expected levels of attack and the sophistication of countermeasures available to the attackers. Some critics of the system now under development have argued that it is fundamentally vulnerable to relatively simple countermeasures because it operates during the mid-course of the attacking missile's trajectory, when decoys are difficult to discriminate from warheads. They believe that the only effective NMD system would be one that operates against the missile during its early flight stage, when the rocket engines are still burning and before it could deploy warheads or decoys. Accordingly, those critics have proposed alternative system configurations, the so-called boost phase systems. There can be no doubt that operating during boost phase is a great advantage to the defensive system. The question, of course, is how does the defense system get access to the missile during its boost phase? Different critics have different answers to that rather fundamental question. Some of them propose to base their system on ships, with one ship being based as close as possible to each of the expected launch sites. Others point out that this will not be close enough to some of the expected launch sites and propose a land-based system which would have to be located in Russia to be close enough to some of the expected launch sites. And a third group argues that neither of those is a practical approach, and the best way to get access to all expected sites is by basing the defensive system on satellites. This last approach implies a constellation of satellites, perhaps as many as 100. During the conference tomorrow, we will hear from advocates of these alternative approaches and get their views on the feasibility of their proposed approach. We also can and will debate what the expected level of damage reduction will be for various approaches and what it will likely cost us to get that level of damage reduction. I must tell you that there are blizzards of papers giving contradictory estimates of the cost of various proposed national missile defense systems. I'll give you just a sampling. Some proponents of the sea-based national missile defense system argue that an effective system can be built for a few billion dollars. The Program Office and the Congressional Budget Office estimate that phase one of the current ground-based system can be built for about $30 billion. Some proponents of a satellite-based system argue that it can be built cheaply because of recent advances in commercial satellite technology. The CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, on the other hand, estimates that a space-based system would cost about $140 billion. So we will be confronted with huge differences in estimates of what the cost of a national missile defense system will be. And perhaps we can at least narrow the range of estimates by focusing on those estimates that have been carefully worked out based on real designs and real design parameters. Whatever we conclude about dollar cost, we will also have to consider geopolitical cost. While there has been much attention to dollar cost, there has been very little thoughtful discussion of the geopolitical cost of a national missile defense deployment, which I hope to correct tomorrow. I expect that our discussion tomorrow will go beyond the usual vague statements that the Russian government and the Chinese government will be unhappy with our national missile defense plans. Indeed, I hope that we will discuss the quite tangible costs associated with a national missile defense deployment. For example, if Russia were to respond to our national missile defense deployment by curtailing operation with the cooperation with the United States in the Comprehensive Threat Reduction Program, it could increase the risk of proliferation of weapons of mass destruction to third world countries. Additionally, it could open the possibility of Russia supporting some of those nations in sophisticated countermeasures. That is, the cost here is measured in terms of an increase in the threat that our national missile defense system would face, both in terms of quality and in terms of timing. Additionally, China might respond by increasing the number of nuclear warheads in their strategic forces beyond their present plans. That is, by increasing the planned number of new generation ICBMs and by putting multiple warheads on their present generation of ICBMs. This increase could be seen by India as an incentive to increase their planned missile force, which could in turn be seen by Pakistan as an incentive to increase theirs. Now, it is hard to measure the cost to the United States of this potential explosion of proliferation, but it is likely to be negative to our own security in ways that are difficult to predict. In some ways, a national missile defense program may be thought of as insurance, a protection against a contingency that has a low probability of occurrence, but one that, if it did occur, could have disastrous consequences. It would not be consistent for me to argue against our country buying insurance for such contingencies. After all, I have bought earthquake insurance for my home in Los Altos Hills, which is, again, a low probability of an occurrence which could have high consequences. Of course, before I bought that policy, I had firm data about the cost of the policy, whereas in the NMD debate, there is still considerable uncertainty on the dollar cost and little understanding of the geopolitical cost. And I have a reasonable belief that I would be able to collect on my policy if an earthquake occurred. Whereas in the national missile debate, there is still this controversy over what the payoff would be if the system were needed. In our discussion tomorrow, I hope we can cover the detailed issues that I've mentioned, but also keep our eye on the bottom line, which is, all things considered, would a deployment of the proposed system really increase our security? If so, at what cost, dollar and geopolitical? And would any of the alternative systems being proposed provide a greater increase in our security at lesser cost? I would like to close my talk this evening with a quote from the British scientist C.P. Snow, one that I share with the graduate engineers in all of my classes. "Technology," he said, "is a strange thing. With one hand, it offers you great gifts, and with the other hand, it stabs you in the back." I use that quote to point out that technology does not have values and can be a force for either good or evil. But I also tell these engineers, these aspiring engineers, that I believe that engineers should have values. And while their products bring society great gifts, they should also do everything they can to see that their technology does not stab society in the back. In a sense, that is the task of our conference tomorrow, to try to influence the direction of the remarkable technology now being developed in this country so that it truly does bring society great gifts. I thank you.
Our thanks to Dr. Perry for his usually incisive analysis of the issue, and I hope we can come up to those expectations tomorrow. Dr. Perry is willing to take a few questions, and I'll turn the mic back over to him.
It ought not to be a partisan issue. It has become one through the years. That's the first answer. The second answer is that in spite of that, both candidates have specifically said that they would favor the deployment of a national missile defense system. But the difference between the way they say that and what they imply is more than a nuanced difference. And I think we would probably have a substantially different outcome between the two candidates. But to a certain extent, we're only speculating at this point. And also, to get really to the point of what this exercise is all about, we hope to be able to influence both candidates in the direction that we think is consistent with a sound national security. Any other question? Dick. Dick will be one of our speakers tomorrow, by the way.
Dick Gerwin. I think one of the critical questions is the extent to which the threat is really assumed to be that from the rogue nations that the Rumsfeld Commission considered as North Korea, Iraq, and Iran, and the threat from China and Russia. So, in framing the issues, what are we supposed to consider tomorrow?
In the consideration of the different systems that are being considered, the alternative systems being considered, some of them, nearly all of them, would have effectiveness against Chinese missiles, but some of them would have very little effectiveness against Russian missiles. And so as we look at the threat, we have to consider the existence of those missiles as a fact. We have to also consider that the stated objective for the system that is being developed now is only third world nations, but it has a capability also, a very substantial capability against the missiles that China has deployed. And particularly in our discussion of geopolitical consequences, which we'll talk about in the afternoon, that should be front and center. Because whether or not we state we are concerned with using this against China, there is an existential fact that it would have that capability. Therefore, it is reasonable to expect a response reaction from the Chinese, and we get into an action-reaction mode. John?
Because we didn't have the capability. That's very different today. We are within a very short period of time of being certain we will have the capability. If that is so, could you say a word or two how the next president, who will be the first president in that situation, how a next president would deal with the issue of having the capability of providing a defense against a limited attack, says, no, I don't want to do that because of the greater geostrategic danger of doing so?
It may be very difficult for the president to take this point of view. But while we will be in the position of mounting some kind of a defense against ballistic missile attack, we will still not be in the position of mounting a defense against nuclear weapons coming in cruise missiles, coming in airplanes, coming in merchant ships, coming in delivery vans. And so any president that suggests by deploying the system that he can defend the nation against a third world nuclear attack would be misleading the nation. So I do believe that that perspective is very important in evaluating the cost-benefit aspect of this deployment. We should never delude ourselves into believing that even if we deploy the system and it works rather well, that we are protecting the nation from a nuclear attack from a third world nation, because that will not be so, no matter how good this system is. Hi, Rob. Deborah's trying to get a microphone back to you.
Thank you. My question is that Most of the information, either on cost or performance, is actually speculative, given that system doesn't exist and the experiments have been rather, we could say either bleak or certainly rare. To what extent will the conference examine what information is actually needed and how one might go about getting it to make the decisions?
I think the conference can do two things. One is try to specify what is needed to make an informed judgment, cost and in performance parameters. Secondly, I think it can be doing a service by discriminating between those systems where we are rather far advanced on making those estimates and those systems where we have only what's called view graph engineering. That is, conceptual descriptions of what a system might be. The system which suffers the most from criticism is the one that is most detailed and specific in its presentation. And so when that system, if and when that system gets shot down and one of the alternative systems come forward, then that alternative system will be worked out in the same level of detail, and it then becomes subject to these kind of criticisms. At the moment, the alternative systems are not being subjected to the same level of criticism that the one that's on the table is right now. That's not to speak for them or against them. It's just saying they have not been subject yet to that same level of detailed scrutiny. I think we owe it to, first of all, point out that difference, and then to secondly, lay out, if you're going to make an informed judgment about an alternative system, what level of detail and what specificity is needed to come to judgments about it. Yes, Dave?
Bill, I was wondering if you would describe to the audience a little bit about the question of what's called self-deterrence. Avoidance of self-deterrence is one of the motives for this system as opposed to deterrence itself. That is, we may be faced, say, the scenario that's often spoken of is an attack from North Korea on the South, and that we feel we are chastened from responding because of fear that without some form of defense, the North Koreans could strike us.
I don't know whether I'm quite up to the task which Dave laid out for me, but in 30 seconds, I'll try to do that. One of the arguments for the deployment of a national missile defense system is that we don't truly expect North Korea, say, to fire, to make an unprovoked attack against the United States. That's not the issue. The issue is we get into some dust-up on the Korean Peninsula, and North Korea calls our bluff by taking an action on the theory that we will not respond even with our conventional forces because we now are deterred by the fact that they have 5 or 10 missiles with nuclear weapons on them. I think if they believe that, they're wrong. And I do believe that it could be made clear to them that they're wrong. So I'm not an advocate of the self-deterrence, but I have tried to explain the concept that Dave just described. Sam?
You brought up the planes and cruise missiles and delivery vans. And I think emphasis has to be made on these other systems. And it seems to me they offer one great advantage over ballistic missiles, that they don't let you know where they came from. That if I wanted to attack the west coast of the United States, the last thing, it seems to me, I would want to use would be a thing with a long streamer on the end that told you where to shoot back. You know, can you comment on the relative weight of these?
Well, I specifically laid out in my talk tonight a charge which I will give the group tomorrow to look at the relative importance of those threats to the United States. And I think Sam has spelled out what is a perfectly sound argument, which is if he were a North Korean or an Iraqi or Iranian and wanted to do great harm to the United States, he might choose, and had a nuclear bomb, he might choose to put that nuclear bomb in a merchant ship or a delivery van or a fake commercial airplane instead of delivering with an ICBM. And the point he was making is that conceivably those methods of delivery could be kept covert. That is, the source
the bomb could be kept confusing, at least. Whereas there's no way to keep, there'll be no mystery as to where the ICBM is coming from if it is launched. We will know that quite precisely. Pitch.
The objection that the non-rogue nations, our hoped-for friends such as China and Russia, have to it is, of course, we could camp behind a defense system and then have our offensive capability. Can we consider a national missile defense system without talking about our plans for our offensive capability?
Well, the whole theory of our strategic Our whole strategic theory for decades has linked together offense and defense, and that is also true in the former Soviet Union, now true in Russia. And that is the philosophical reason why the Russians object to our going ahead with the national missile defense system and point out that one of the obvious responses to this would be for them not only as we terminate the ABM treaty, they would also be inclined to terminate the SALT treaty, the START treaty, and any future START treaties. Not, they say, in a fit of pique, but because the logic is these systems, the offensive and defensive systems, tie together. They certainly tie together in our minds when we negotiated those treaties in the first place, and at least most Russians that I've talked to believe that they still tie together. So it is... There's a great philosophical difficulty in trying to separate offensive and defensive. The problem then of one nation, and only one nation, moving to a defensive system then is that it stimulates other nations to move to offensive systems. That sounds awfully much like an arms race, a nuclear arms race, which is the thing we just came out of during the Cold War and are not anxious to get back into. That's one of the primary arguments against going, at least unilaterally, to a national missile defense system. President Clinton believed, on some evidence but not weighty evidence, that he could get the Russian government to proceed in a cooperative program so that he somehow kept those two linked together. But I have never talked to any Russian official who shared his optimism on that. So I'm not so sure that that is correct. And if it is not correct, then the problem that you lay out is front and center. Yes?
I'm Karen Gattieri, a postdoctoral fellow at CSAC, and I'm on the record as saying I still don't miss the Cold War. One of the things I didn't enjoy about the Cold War was the risk of inadvertent or accidental nuclear war, and some very prominent people, including people at CSAC, have worked on that issue. Now, I'm not a rocket scientist, but when I look at the question of national or theater missile defense systems, I see a very quick action-reaction time implying very short decision cycles. And I wonder to what extent is the risk of inadvertent or accidental war an issue to think about in framing the national missile defense debate?
The action-reaction cycle, which was front and center all during the Cold War, would become, I think, front and center again under at least some of the scenarios that we're looking at for a national missile defense system. That's one discriminator, by the way, between defense systems that operate in mid-course, where you have perhaps 10 minutes or so to decide what to do, and systems that operate during boost phase, where you have to commit to a launch within seconds after you have concluded that the missile has been fired. So that is a factor in any national missile defense system, but it is a more, the factor is dramatically aggravated with the boost phase systems relative to the mid-course or even the terminal phase system.
Do more, or?
I think some of our visitors have come from the East, and it's 11:30 Eastern time. We ought to be thoughtful to them and call it a night.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. It was great talking to you.
Well, many thanks to Bill. We'll be talking about this much more tomorrow. Thank you to Jonathan Fanton and the MacArthur Foundation, and to Bill Owens and the Carnegie Corporation and their colleagues who are here, to my good friend Chip Blacker and the Institute for International Studies. And we'll see those of you who are going to be at the conference at 7:30 for breakfast, 8 o'clock for the start of the conference. And many thanks to each and every one of you for coming this evening and engaging in this discussion. Good night.